Hello and welcome back to Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we discuss whether Arsenal are bottling the title race. We open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we've got a mailbag for you, answering a bunch of your questions on football and everything else. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another midweek recording of Unseen Incidents. Pete, what are you drinking? You're lifting a glass of something that looks lovely to your mouth, but I assume it's just like hydration liquid.
No, that's here. Did I tell you that? Remember, maybe 2 seasons ago, I told you about my special cup.
Yeah, I do know of your special cup.
Devastatingly, so the special cup broke.
You're actually like a baby where you're just like, I can only drink out of my special cup.
Yeah, with Bonnie, we actually have 3 different versions of the same like comforter, just so that if she loses one or one gets left somewhere.
Yeah, wash one, dry one.
Yeah, she has one. There's always one in operation no matter what, and potentially one always a spare to hand as well. But no, the special cup broke over 6 months ago. But then Jess got me a new one for Christmas in my stocking.
The same one?
No. It's smaller. Being
honest with Jess, possibly listening. Not listening.
I'm definitely listening.
Is it as good?
It's better than not having a special cup.
That's a no. That's a clear no.
The other one was kind of like, I assume it was similar to, you know, when you get like a wok that you never wash. It's like seasoned. It's cured.
Yes. Yeah.
But the flavor bakes into it over the years, kind of like cast iron as well. I feel like that was what happened with the original special cup. This one will achieve that in a few years. Maybe it just needs to get seasoned more. It's also just a little bit smaller, which I don't love, but it is better, significantly better than not having a cup. But the drink you were referring to today was 17 degrees. I don't know if you noticed. Basically summer.
I did notice. I was outside a lot today.
Bizarre. So I've just gone full summer mode and brought back the sparkling water with what I refer to as diluting juice. So it's a sparkling...
I forget that you call it diluting juice. It's so silly.
It's a ice sparkling water. And there was no lemon available in the house.
Oh, no.
Annoying. So I've gone with orange and pineapple.
Okay.
Because it was at our like summer fruits or something.
That sounds pretty good to me. Mm. Okay.
Yeah, it's quite nice. It's Lilt-esque.
All right.
Which we all know is one of the best fizzy drinks ever made.
It is one of the superior fizzy drinks. I can't deny it.
A can of Lilt when you were hungover, when I was hungover, any point is just unbelievable. And obviously they've discontinued it. Well, there was a whole myth that Iron Brew was actually manufactured as like medicinal, have like medicinal properties.
Like Coke and Dr. Pepper, right?
Yeah. But yeah, Lilt has been discontinued, but it is now Blue Fanta, which is really difficult to find.
Sorry, what do you mean? As in, like, that's the taken the place? Or do you mean, like, that's what they replaced Lilt with, like, explicitly?
I'm pretty sure the company that owns Fanta owned Lilt, but they discontinued Lilt and then merged the flavour into their family of Fanta flavours in the UK, which is now the Blue Fanta.
But the Blue Fanta, I instinctively don't trust. Like, I don't want to drink a fucking blue drink.
I agree. It's blue can.
No offence, yeah. Americans, but I'm not a fucking redneck. Like,
yeah, with your big gulp.
Yeah, exactly. Or like my fucking, you know, Mountain Dew. In my experience, Mountain Dew is not bright blue. I like Pecari Sweat.
But I've never poured it out, but it's a blue can of Fanta. I don't think it's actually the liquid's blue. It's just the can is blue in the same way that like the red Fanta is, what is it? Well, whatever it is. The can is blue, but it's notoriously hard to find. I've only found it in Morley's.
Okay.
It's quite difficult to source. But yeah, that is where Lilt is currently in the UK.
Emma loves Lilt. And so at one point I bought her a crate of Lilt. And since then she has not had a Lilt.
She drank too much of a good thing.
She drank a lot of Lilt. But also I think this might have been post sugar disaster, you know?
What, the sugar ducks?
Yeah, so it was just like, okay. Mm. You know? Like that's the thing now. Basically all fizzy drinks are just not good anymore.
Well, you like really sugary, really sharp fizzy drinks?
No, I just don't think there's a... in the sense that, like, I think that there's... That's what fizzy drinks are for. I don't really drink fizzy drinks very often, but when I do, I'm like, it should be sugary. If I don't want a sugary drink, I simply won't drink it. Don't be one of those people who's just like, I actually don't like really sweet things. You know, like the fake sophisticates. Those are my least favorite people. There are so many, I know so many people like that who are like, I actually don't really like very sweet things. And I think they're always trying to say they're really sophisticated. It's just like, oh, I prefer a subtle flavor. And it just always makes me laugh. But a fizzy drink, to me, it's like, you know, the vegetarian sausage. Or yeah, like, you know, my mother-in-law will sometimes say, you know, oh, I've found this like healthy brownie recipe or whatever, and I'm just like, I've got a healthy brownie. It's not eating a brownie. Like that's how you enjoy a healthy brownie. A healthy brownie is a carrot. Like that like doesn't matter. I think when you start replacing stuff, you're just like, you're aware that you're taking on an inferior version of the product.
When I was deep in the bro sphere of like the bro diet, probably 12, 13 years ago. Maybe like 10 years, say 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Deep in the brew diet, my replacement for things like chocolate were basically blended dates.
Oh.
Rolled into a ball and then like rolled in cocoa powder.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was sweet enough and you got the flavor of chocolate, but it was just basically just mashed up dates.
Dates are a bit of a cheat code, I think. There's, oh my God, have you had the like the Forest Feast dates that are like, they're stuffed with peanut butter and covered in chocolate? It's fucking insane. Like, it's like, it's so many good things in one go, but you can eat like one and then you're like, it's like eating a whole sticky toffee pudding.
Yeah, so it sounds like something like out of the Bruce Bogtrotter's recipe book.
They're so big as well. They're like the size of a bollock. They're so big. It's unreal.
Universal unit of measurement. A bollock.
For oval things. Surely, yes.
Forest Feast dates. Let me see
these cunts. Let's see these cunts. Brilliant. What, you want to see, like, can I see the... You need to see it up against, like, an ordinary size... You know when you like go to a clothes website... You know when they go to a clothes website and they're like, the guy is, like, 5'11"?
Yeah, yeah.
You need to see, see it and you'll be like, for reference, this guy has... large hands.
Yeah, peanut butter, milk, chocolate, dates. Double dipped.
Yeah, crazy.
Interesting.
They are fucking good, but they are, they're a lot, I would say. I wouldn't try and eat more than one. Anyway, what the fuck are we talking about? Yeah, okay, so today we were going to talk about whether Arsenal are bottling the league title, because it's like the big narrative right now. And also because I think it's interesting it's in one sense, as in... the real sense, it's not interesting at all. but then I think there are lots of other ways in which, like, I think there are lots of interesting things to talk about. So, I mean, where do you want to start with this? Like, I guess we should start with like why we're having this conversation, which is that the gap in the league has narrowed to 2 points, assuming City win their game in hand. Yeah. Which actually, okay, so that's part of the issue here. Everybody's talking like Manchester City are just going to like rattle off like 10 wins to finish the season or something. The first thing to say is there's no reason to believe that to be true. Like, Man City are not only not as good as they used to be, since Christmas, you know what Arsenal look like since Christmas in the underlying numbers? They look like the best team in the league. Arsenal have like a plus 1.3 expected goal difference per 90 since Christmas. Then it's Man United at under plus one. And then it's Liverpool just behind them. And then you start getting to City. And if you look at the games... since, you know, the beginning of January, Arsenal, since New Year's Day, played 9, won 4, drawn 4, lost 1. Man City, played 9, won 4, drawn 4, lost 1.
Yeah.
And the one that they lost, they really deserved to lose. Like, they got the shit kicked out of them by Man United. Whereas the Arsenal game with Man United was, like, pretty even. Mm. United scored 3 goals from 0.7 XG or something.
Yeah. I think it might have been lower than that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, but it's like, to be fair, I would make the case that United were quite good in that game and Arsenal weren't that good. But the City-United game, like, City got absolutely demolished. And, you know, now there's this whole thing of just, like, City's destiny is in their own hands. Like, if they win all their games, then they win the league, which, of course, is true for Arsenal as well. The other thing that's true is that if City want to win the league, they kind of need to get ahead now. Because Arsenal have their tougher run now and they end the season with, like, 5 easier games. Whereas City have their easier run now and they end the season with their run of tougher games. So this is the point where they need to close the gap. All this said, Arsenal are still top of the league. Yeah. And, you know, nobody's really managing to paint a compelling narrative of like what's wrong with them. So, for example, what went wrong in like the Brentford game or the Wolves game or the Forest game or the United game? Like, to me, there's no through line through these games, really. Or rather, there are some tactical through lines that I think we could bring out. But there's nothing in the data that suggests, or even in watching the games, I think, that suggests that there's something particularly similar about these games. Like, against Forest, the narrative has been Arsenal created nothing, even though they created kind of more than they created against Spurs. Like, but the narrative has been Arsenal created nothing. Whereas nobody's saying that about Wolves. In the Wolves game, they were like, Arsenal bottled it and started going long too much. In the United game, it's like Arsenal kind of lost control and got fucked by long rangers, you know, like some mistakes, basically. Like, the Brentford game, I don't really know what the narrative is there. Like, the narrative should just be Arsenal were shit because they were shit and Brentford were much better than them. But, you know, it's not like there is a thing that Arsenal do or a problem they have. And we've now seen four or five games where that has been the problem, you know? All those drop points to me are fairly similar. Because, you know, like the Wolves game is not them failing to attack. They're up 2-0. They lost control of the game. Whereas the Forest game is like, oh, Arsenal's attack wasn't good enough to make a breakthrough. So it just kind of feels like what we haven't seen in this run would really worry me, I guess, is like something that's getting found out in Arsenal that would make me then really worried. If it was just like Arsenal can be attacked in this way and teams are consistently doing it.
Yeah.
Like, all of these drop points to me are kind of slightly different cases. And when you look at the underlying numbers over this stretch, they're also still by far the best in the league. And I just kind of am like,
I think
Arsenal are just fine.
Like, so what I think is interesting is that...
Doesn't mean they'll win the league, but I think they're
fine. Yeah, sure. But I agree that there's no negative trend across these like 7-8 games that we're talking about here of Arsenal bottling the league, of Arsenal dropping points.
Yeah.
But there is actually a positive trend in that Not only do Arsenal still have the best underlying numbers in the league, the underlying numbers that they have defensively across this 8-game period that everybody's criticising is actually better in some metrics than the previous 20 match weeks when everyone was like, oh, Arsenal are the best team in the world. They're going to walk the league. Across the last 8 games, they have a lower expected goals against per 90 and they've conceded less shots on target per 90 in this period where they're apparently bottling the league. And a lot of the points that they dropped weren't about necessarily Arsenal being bad. They were more about finishing that they faced or like general variance in that. Like if you look at the Wolves game, okay, sure, I think Arsenal went 2-0 up and I guess that's the closest one that you can say to being a bottling. I think they had like a 98% win probability from where they were and I think they took the foot off the gas. They went a bit too conservative and they let Wolves get a foothold and get back into the game.
I would make the case that that was like pure bottle.
I think where they felt the pressure, yeah.
I think Arsenal like completely like fucked themselves. I think everyone was shitting themselves in that game in a way that I don't think is true in the other games.
Yes, I think that's the only one you can say of that. And even then, with Arsenal shitting themselves, I think it is still unlikely if you play that game back exactly the same way it played. I think it's unlikely that very many results end with Arsenal not winning that game. Wolves scored with their only 2 shots on target. They had 5 shots total and under 0.3 expected goals. The Wolves United game, overall, combined, opposition generated about 1 expected goal, but they scored 5 goals overall. So there's just like finishing anomalies there where like Patrick Dorgu's goal, super low XG, is just, you know, one that is just like, you know what, fair enough. Like it's fallen to him. He swung a bit at it. You can say he meant to finish like that, or you can say he just wanted to hit it really hard and see what happened. Mm-hmm. Wherever you land on that, it's really hard to mitigate for United scoring multiple goals with low XG. Same with Wolves. The Forest and Liverpool games, Arsenal didn't create much, but also Forest and Liverpool managed 0 shots on target combined.
I don't know. I mean, like the Liverpool game, Arsenal literally created nothing. Whereas like the Forest game, they did have like close to 2 expected goals. And quite often, I think the good Arsenal games and the bad Arsenal games are really similar. It's just like, you know, the good Arsenal game is they score a set piece or they score a long ranger and the game changes. But I think that's true for a lot of teams in the league right now. Like, I really don't think there is a team in the league that I think is just irresistible in attack. City certainly aren't. Liverpool should be, but are not. Chelsea actually have been kind of that way recently, but Chelsea give up a lot of the other end. United have had moments, but also then, you know, they go away to West Ham and they kind of get pounded. So I'm just like, I do think there are problems with Arsenal's attack and we will go on to that. Like I definitely have issues with Arsenal, but not issues where I'm like, wow, things are getting worse. And, you know, like you say, the Wolves game, you look at Wolves, like, look, we've only got fucking understat numbers here. But, like, they've got the win probability for Arsenal in that game, given the chances created, at 90%. Expected points, 2.78 for Arsenal in that game. Yeah. And you're like, right, okay.
And I think the win percentage was above 98% win probability when they were 2-0 up.
Now, like we say, I do think... So I would agree with you. The United and Forest performances, I think, were unlucky in some ways. I don't really think that the Forest attacking performance is that much worse than Spurs. It's just that the shots go in. But I do think that in this run, there are things Arsenal have done. And I do think Arsenal could think about this. Like, look, here's the thing. If Arsenal just play the way they've played for this season up till now, the likelihood is they win the league. They're still at like 65% or something to win the league. City are worse than them. City's schedule is worse than theirs. Both of these teams have Champions League, and City's squad, you'd probably argue, is like a bit thinner than Arsenal's right now. City are still giving up quite a lot to other teams. Like defensively, they're not quite at the races, despite the kind of Nico O'Reilly has fixed the defense like angle. So if like nothing changes, Arsenal are still favored. And Arsenal being favored also means
heavily
that, like,
favored.
65%, I mean, like, they were
big,
80
big enough.
I know, but they were 80-90 before. But of course, sure. Okay, so here's one way to look at that, which is that, like, everybody now is saying, well, what if Arsenal drop points against, like, Chelsea and City beat Leeds this weekend, right? Then it's like, oh my God, what if, like City could go above Arsenal, you know, in the near future? And you think, well, yeah, but equally, if City have a bad result, if Arsenal have a bad result, City could go above them by, like, a point. And Arsenal are still in the hunt for the league. Like, yeah. They could just beat City like that, or they could just be better over this run of games by 2 points. And they'd be fine. But if City have a couple of bad results, they're just out of the title race. Like that's the effect of having a points advantage at this stage, even when it's a small points advantage. But I think, you know, there are ways to optimize. And I do think Arteta's done some dumb shit. Like, you look at the Forest game, and Arsenal started with Martinelli on the left wing and Timber at left back.
Mm-hmm.
And in that game, you look at it and you're like, okay, so you've got an attacking subunit there of Rice, Timber and Martinelli all on the left side. Like, what the fuck's that? Like, what are they going to do? And I do think that this has happened too many times this season. Like, Arteta will put his team in a suboptimal situation, which he must know to be suboptimal. And I think he just assumes, like, my player quality, team dynamics will get them through. And Billy Carpenter, who's like the best Arsenal writer around, like wrote a long piece about this with much more detail. But his basic point was like really simple and obvious in a way, which was like, these attacking units need to have the right blend of attributes. So like against a city, if you've got space, Martinelli and Rice might be fine on that side. But against a sitting defense, like who's the incisive attacking passer there? Who's the dribbler there? Like, you just don't have it. So you need to have, like, the right blend of profiles. And Arsenal have had, I mean, look, one thing is, we basically haven't talked about Arsenal's injuries this season because they're top of the league. But if Arsenal were third, we'd be like, well, they've been really injured. But the fact that is, they're top of the league and they've been really injured, and now they're kind of getting healthy again. And you know, Jesus can't really start games, and obviously Arteta doesn't really trust Eze to start a lot of games, certainly not a left wing, and Odegaard's not really fit. But that means that quite often Arteta's like, well, I have to use these three guys, but I can only use them late in games. They can't start. And that means that at the end of games, you often have the guys who you would want at the beginning against the sitting defense, you know, like the unlocker players, like Jesus. As Billy Carpenter talks about it, small space players versus big space players.
Sure.
But instead, Arsenal are often starting games with like Madueke, Martinelli. Madueke is fine in both situations, I think. But Madueke, Martinelli, Jokeres, and Hincapié at left back. And then at the end of the game, you've got all the little like nippy guys when there's actually space. Mm. And not only space to run into in attack, but that means that pace, which is going to stop teams pushing up too much. And I think more energetic guys to press. Because I think that Jesus doesn't really have, he just doesn't have the legs to press like he used to. Whereas Jokeres has been a surprisingly useful defensive player for Arsenal, I would say. So there's that, and I think, you know, conservative choices, which has always been the issue with Arteta. But at the same time, conservative choices were happening in the autumn when Arsenal were like running away with the league. Those conservative choices are happening now still. And everyone's like, well, the team's too conservative. It's like they were fucking too conservative in the autumn as well. Like, I do think they can afford to open it up a bit. Like, do you need to concede 0.5 expected goals a game? mightn't it be better to maybe concede 0.6 or 0.7, but your attack is like getting that much more because your players are that much better than your opponents? Like, it might be that you could, it might not be, but it might be you can open the game up a little bit, and not even like they get 0.2 XG and you get 0.2, but they get 0.2 and you get 0.4 because your players are better, you know?
Yeah, kind of basically exponentially compound.
Well, yeah, I don't know if it really works that way, but it feels like if I've got better players and the game is open, that favors me because I've got better players. And I'm not saying the game should be open, but it could be a bit more open. And I think...
kind of like controlled chaos, I guess.
Yeah, and there's just... I don't know. I mean, like, where do you want to go with this? I've got more stuff to say, but, like, I'm kind of taking over. So what stands out to you?
I get why people are saying, oh, you know, it is Arsenal bottling the league and all that stuff, because it does fit the narrative that we've seen before, you know. Mid to late season wobble, similar to prior title challenges. They finished third 3 years in a row, or second 3 years in a row.
You just turn on the Wolves game, which was the only game that night, and you're like, Arsenal are literally... like just punting it out of defense panically against the bottom team in the league. Like, what the fuck are they doing?
It was a really weird thing to see. If you look at the stats after they went 2-0 up, they really like kind of fell apart going forward. They only had two extra shots after they went 2-0 up. They had about half 50% possession, and their pass completion was like dog shit, like 75% after they went 2-0 up. So
yeah, it was
a real kind of like, that was the only time that I feel that this argument actually has any merit though. That Arsenal are actually bottling the league.
Yeah,
well, because you could watch it and you'd be like, oh shit, like that. They are kind of falling apart, it seems here. I think the argument, in a wider sense, it doesn't really have that much legs, because I think it's just amplified by the kind of cadence of results. Because if you look at the last 10 match weeks, the gap, because everybody's looking at the gap now being like, oh, City are 2 points back, or City will be 2 points back. And also it's a weird narrative about how City are kind of expected or guaranteed to get the points that they haven't got yet, and Arsenal are almost expected to keep dropping points.
Yeah.
Which, again, it doesn't work like that. So if you look at the last 10 match weeks, the closest City have been to Arsenal are 2 points back. So not including what they are now. So before that, 10, I think it was 10 match weeks ago, they were 2 points back. The maximum they've been away is 7 points. So that gap has fluctuated between 2 and 7 points. They're still within those parameters. Even if City win their next game, say they do. Let's just, for argument's sake, say City have played 28 games and are 2 points behind Arsenal, who have also played 28 games. They are still within the parameters of the last 10 match weeks fluctuation. But nobody was really saying, people are only saying now that Arsenal are bottling the league. If those results, the cadence of those results, both for City and Arsenal, happened in a different way, so that City were like 2 points behind, then they were like 4 points behind, then it was 3 points, then it was 4 points, then it was 2 points, and it stayed much closer. Nobody will be saying Arsenal are bottling league. Everybody's saying this is a, you know, pretty close title race. Arsenal still look the best team, but you know, it could go down to the wire. The reality is that Arsenal still have the best underlying numbers in the league. They still are top of the table. Their gap hasn't been eroded, significantly eroded. If you look at the last 10 match weeks, Arsenal have the same amount of points as City, and they have 4 more points than Villa. So their two closest rivals, and I'm treating Villa as an actual rival here for the title is quite generous. But their two closest rivals in the league have either got the same amount of points as them or less in the last 10 match weeks, which is apparently is a period where Arsenal are bottling the league.
Yeah.
They've actually just been at best or at worst on par with their closest rivals. And it just seems that like it fits a narrative. It's funny that, you know, Arsenal are always the bridesmaid, never the bride. And we've seen it happen before. But the reality is that Arsenal still top of the league. They still have a points buffer. They have the best underlying numbers. They've been, you know, they've been fantastic. They're still in all competitions. They're in a Carabao Cup final. They've gone 8-for-8 in the Champions League. They are still in the FA Cup and have a pretty easy draw, I think, in the fifth round. They'll progress in that. You know, their season has been fantastic so far. That doesn't mean it has to be perfect. It will not. No season will ever be perfect.
Yeah.
This is just a little bit of a hiccup, a little bit of a wobble. And yeah, I think it's kind of, it's a lot of fanfare made out from not a huge amount of substance. And when you actually look at the fact that Arsenal still have that lead, City have made no like progress on them from when they were 10 weeks ago. Villa have dropped away further. All the underlying numbers are either the same or better. It's like, for me, and like you say, they're getting fitter as well. For me, yeah, I get why people want to tie the argument to be like, oh, Arsenal bottling again, but realistically speaking, of course, this isn't guaranteed that Arsenal win the league. Nothing's guaranteed. There is, you think you said, what, 65% probability? That means there's a 35% probability that they don't win the league.
Which is like a big chance.
Which is, it's over one in three, right? So in 10 game weeks, we could be sitting here and City could have won the league because they could have just, like, Erling Haaland and his fucking, like, could have just fucking battle-rammed his way through to the Premier League title again. He could just score relentlessly and that'd be the difference. That is totally possible. But on the balance of probabilities based on the setup of each squad, how each squad is playing, the games remaining and the state of the table and each team's underlying numbers, Arsenal are definitely favourites for the league here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do not think they are bottling it. I think they've had a couple of poor results. I think only one of them they are truly to blame for. I think the other ones, they got unlucky to a degree and there was lots of chances that generally wouldn't go in. Certainly not multiple ones go in the same game. They happened to just go in and turn the game. And then there was, you know, like the nil-all draws that were a bit dry. Okay, they you know, they didn't create anything against Liverpool, but also Liverpool didn't create anything against them. And it was just like a series of results where it looks bad because I think they won 3-8 of their last 8 in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Doesn't look good for a team you're saying is the best team in Europe and, you know, undefeated in Champions League and going to win the title for the first time in 20 years. But when you compare them to the people like directly competing for the title against them, they are still in a better position and still a better team.
Yeah, I think we're just like, we're still living in the world where we expect Man City to kind of like rack up like wins for just like the last third of the season. And it could happen. Like, of course it could happen. But like, there's nothing to suggest it will happen.
The last time that happened was the Liverpool 99-97 point season, I think, where City went on like a 13-game win streak at the end of the season. But they had players like De Bruyne and David Silva.
They also did it a couple of years ago, you know, when like they... Arsenal, I think, dropped points like in one game. That was the last time Arsenal bottled the league when they like dropped points in like one game after Christmas.
Was it Southampton?
And then something like that. And then City won by a point or 2 points, whatever it was. Yeah, like this is the thing. I think everybody thinks of like Man City as like, well, okay, they can just do that. And they could.
Yeah.
But when you look at them, when you watch them and when you look at their stats, I'm like, this does not look like a team that is going to win 10 games in a row.
Yeah, the other squads, you're like,
City 2 years ago, you were like, that is a... Like, 2 years ago, Arsenal were probably the best team in the league, but like, it was two teams that were very close to each other. And this season, there's like a clear difference between them. And so City either need to get better or get lucky, and Arsenal need to probably also get unlucky.
Yeah. You
know, if those two teams draw, for example, at the Etihad, and win all their other games, like City still won't win the league. Like, you know, that's where we are. So they need a couple of things to go their way. Now, like I say, I completely will not be surprised if it happens, because things that have a 35% chance of happening happen a lot. They happen they happen all the time.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess it's then maybe worth talking about like some other things that I think Arsenal can think about, like the ways that they can try and optimize. Because like, there are frustrations here. And I do think, like, if you haven't got Marino or Havertz there, you can't just be playing these aimless punts up the middle.
Mm.
Like, they were doing it against Wolves. And actually, I think they'd have got away with it against Wolves if they had Marino or Havertz, right? Because those balls would have got brought down. But nobody is doing that in this Arsenal front line. And when Arsenal do it, Arsenal fans are like, oh, Gyökeres, he's so bad with these balls. He's always been bad with them. And, like, I kind of think, like, that's not his fault. Like, if you're asking players to do things they're not good at, that is your fault, not the player's fault.
He was better
fault.
In a North London derby, but still.
Sure, but
below
also
50% aerial duel win rate.
You could still play long balls for Gyökeres, but you've just got to play them into the channels for him to run onto, rather than like at his fucking head.
Yeah,
like, he's just at his sweet.
It's like the way United played under Van Gaal when they stuck Fellaini up top because his. Like his chest control was like a gravitational pull. So he just punted it up to him and he just fucking elbowed cunts and just took the ball down in his chest and then did absolutely nothing with it.
Mm.
Whereas Gyökeres doesn't get that far.
Yeah, Gyökeres is the opposite. It's like if he gets it down, maybe he could do something, but he can't get it down. Yeah. So, you know, with that stuff, I'm like, if Havertz comes back, I wouldn't be surprised to see that kind of stuff become like much more effective. But Havertz is I don't know if he's coming back, like, really.
Has there been an update on his injury?
Yeah, then they said he was maybe going to be available for the weekend, and then he didn't quite make it. So they've been saying all season, like, he might nearly be back. So he might nearly be back. And if he is back, I do think Arsenal will be better.
Sure.
Just to have that option later on in games. So anyway, that's one thing. A fit Odegaard would help. Like, he's played fewer minutes in the league than Eze this season. Like, Eze, who everyone's like, Arteta never plays him. Like, he, even in the Brentford game, Arsenal had the one goal lead. Then they conceded an equaliser. And Odegaard kind of injured himself not defending the equaliser. But if he hadn't done that, I wouldn't have been surprised if Arsenal had been able to get control back in that game. Because they looked pretty good until they conceded that goal in the second half. He did stay on the pitch, but he just couldn't run. He literally was not involved for the rest of the game.
Oh, yeah, was they basically played with 10?
Yeah, he just looked... He kind of just looked fucked. Like, it was strange.
Are you saying if they didn't concede, but he was basically still immobile, or if he didn't injure himself?
I'm saying if they conceded, but he hadn't injured himself.
Sure, yeah.
Then I do think they'd have looked... Maybe they wouldn't have won the game, but I do think they would have at least looked better than they did. And that was... And to be clear, that's by far the worst game in this run, right? Like, they were way worse in that game than they were against United, worse than against Forest. Like, that was a game where they were actually the inferior team.
Yeah,
like, on the XG, and I think to the eye, you were just like, Brentford are all over them.
The Wolves game was bad, but only the kind of latter stage in isolation. If you look at the whole game...
Brentford, they were bad for, like, most of the game, bar, like, 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Where, after half-time, where I was like, oh, Arsenal might just turn it on and win now. So, but anyway, to go back to the combinations thing, like, I think you've got to pick those right combinations. So if you've got an off-ball runner in that zone, like Hincapié, for example, who is that a kind of off-ball runner from fullback, you can't pair him with Martinelli unless you've got like an absolute superstar passer and dribbler. Like, for example, if you've got Saka playing 10 and he's drifting over to that side, maybe that can still work. But fundamentally, if you want to play Hincapié, you probably need to play Trossard or Eze. If you want to play Martinelli, you probably need to play Calafiori. Like this is simple. You just need like complementary units. And I do think that as much as Arsenal can, getting Odegaard, Saka, White, or Saka, Madueke, White as the kind of right-hand unit will just sort that side out. Like, White is just a much more useful attacking fullback than Timber is. Like, he just simply is. And I also think that these guys, you know, I said this to Ted on the transfer floor on Monday, but I was like, Hincapié and Timber are very good technical players, you know, and they've come from technical teams. However, they're like Arsenal's least technical fullbacks. And that does mean when you're in a game like Wolves, where you're under pressure and apparently nobody backs themselves to like pass out or dribble out, you do lose something.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if Ben White has more
key passes per 90 than Eze and Martinelli.
Yeah, but Ben White, I mean, sure. But like, Ben White, but more importantly, he's a really good passer from deep. And Lewis Skelly is an amazing dribbler from deep and a good passer. And Calafiori is a bit of both as well. And having one of those guys can help you get out of pressure when you are under the cosh. There was nobody in that Wolves game. And also part of that is Odegaard, right, not being fit. But there was nobody in that Wolves game who could just control the game and take them out of it. I do kind of believe that if Arsenal had put on Lewis Skelly and had had White and had had Odegaard from that same position, they'd have just been able to pass it around for 20 minutes and it would have been fine. You know, Odegaard does control Arsenal. And Zubimendi, I mean, I think we ignore the fact that Zubimendi has played so many minutes in his first league season in a new league. And there are, and as good as he's been, there are moments when you see it. That was one of those moments where I was like, if you'd been here another year, I feel like you might go over to Gabriel and the backline generally and say, guys, fucking sort yourselves out. David Raya, stop kicking it long, you fucking idiot. Like, let's just play it around the back. No offense, it's Wolves. Like, we will pass our way out. It will be fine. They're getting relegated, guys. Like, it would have been okay. And in this game, like, no one really did that. And I do think that, like, a fit Odegaard does that, for example. And Lewis Skelly, like, okay, he could get himself into trouble with dribbling, but he rarely does. And he does get Arsenal out of pressure all the time with his dribbling.
And you think the amount of trouble you can get into against Wolves is limited. It's not like you're away at the Etihad.
Well, especially if you're two goals up, it's not like...
Well, yeah.
It's not like he's dribbling out of the back and everyone else is upfield.
Yeah.
You can have him dribble out of the back.
And still have a set defence.
and still have a set defense, exactly. Yeah. And it would be totally fine. But like, so I think that like a bit more defensive possession is part of it. I think like paying attention to the profiles in attack is part of it. And that is something that Arteta has been getting wrong quite a lot this season, in my opinion. Like, there are lots of games where I look at the attack and I'm like, really? Like against Forest, like I say, you start with like Gyökeres, Martinelli, Madueke front line against a fucking Sean Dyche Forest team away. What? Why? Like no one thinks that's going to work. It almost worked from set pieces. But why would you think that would work? Like, anybody can tell you, like, that's not going to fucking work, bro. And there's been too much of that. I do think there are other things that can help here. So I think like playing Eze as a left wing can help. Because actually, if you've got Incapié or even Calafiori, he's not really going to be playing left wing. Those guys, Calafiori sure. wants to go inside more than outside, but he can go outside.
Yeah.
Incapié does really want to go outside like a proper fullback. And when he wants to do that, that means Eze's inside.
Yeah, he's an inside forward, basically. Yeah.
And then you've got a runner, like a very powerful runner in Incapié, who's also quite scary for crashing the back post on crosses, right?
Mm.
And then, so you've got, this is your four behind the striker. You've got Incapié, Eze, Urgo, Saka behind a striker. Like, how do you defend that?
Yeah.
Or it's Incapié, Eze, Saka, Madueke. Again, how do you defend that? It's very difficult. So I think that's the thing. I think the Saka as a number 10 experiment is quite good as well. Because Urgor, he does always want to drift right. Like, it's where he wants to go. And it's made that right-hand unit, like, very effective, generally. But when Saka started there, we actually saw him go out left as well. Mm. Because he's equally comfortable on both sides. So when the left side needed help, Saka would shuttle all the way over there. When the right side needed help, Saka would shuttle all the way over there. And because Saka's in the middle, it also means that it felt like the team was looking for the right wing less, because they weren't looking for the right wing. They were looking for Saka.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so having him in the middle, I do think made for a more balanced attack. And like, again, how do you defend it? Like, Saka and Madueke are both on the pitch. Madueke comes inside, Saka drifts out wide. Like, or Saka comes inside and Madueke's out wide. Eze's there as well. Like, they cross over. Like, it's just fucking impossible to deal with. Like,
especially if you're trying to like double team or like limit individual players when they're constantly moving and pulling players out of position. It's just like, do you pass over? Do you go with? It's like, it asks so many questions of defenses that over time, over a 90-minute period, like, that will cause holes and weaknesses across like defenses easily.
Yeah,
just by virtue of trying to track everything.
And everyone there is a threat to dribble and shoot, at least.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Eze and Saka are also threats to create.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of stuff I think you could do. And you know, like, you playing White more, I think, as well, and some as well, the way the midfielders are used. Like, Rice is always pushed out left. Okay, fair enough. But I do think that Arsenal get more change out of him often when he goes out right, because he's a good crosser and he likes a shot from that right-hand side, which is weird, right? Going across the keeper to the far side.
Yeah.
But he's really good at the whipped ball. And I think, again, this is something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, which is like trying to create situations that work for the stuff your guys are good at. So Rice takes really dangerous corners for Arsenal. Okay.
Yeah.
But if you push him out to the left side, he's rarely going to get a chance to get just like a free cross into the box the way he gets on a corner. You know, teams aren't really going to let him come inside on his right and just have loads of space to cross. Whereas on the right-hand side, he can just whip that ball in. And then you get guys like Calafiori and Incapié attacking the back stick. You get a number 10 in there. You get a striker in there. Like, Arsenal need to be using stuff like that more. And it's kind of weird they don't. It's weird that for like a team that is so into set pieces, Arsenal haven't tried to think of ways to take their set piece strength
into open play. Like, I've just looked at your like crossing numbers and your list, middle table for attempts and success. Like, you're not really attempting a huge amount.
And I don't think you need to attempt a huge amount, but I just think that like in a moment where you see an opportunity on, especially when you've got a Calafiori or an Incapié, like that is a moment, or when you need a goal late in games, you're like, okay, this is a moment where Zubimendi and the right back and Saliba stay back. And Gabriel, we've seen this happen at times this season where Gabriel has gone herring into the box from open play.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you can do that without it being that risky.
Yeah, I think that's the difference. Like, if you're trying to emulate your set piece dominance and strength in open play, I think a lot of that does hinge on Gabriel being in the box, because otherwise you're basically pinning it mostly on Gyökeres or somebody crashing the back post.
I don't think that's true, like, because I think that Gabriel is great in the air. I do not think that Gabriel is, like, so much better in the air than everybody else in the league. I think what makes Gabriel special, like, in attack, is I think he is great in the air, and I think Arsenal have great deliverers from set pieces, and Arsenal run plays in order to get him space to get those headers. That is what it is.
Yeah, but that's very difficult to do from open play.
I don't think it's that difficult. You can choreograph those moves. You're like, when Rice gets the ball in that area, you guys know your runs. Like, that is the way teams work, right? Like, teams are like, okay, when we get a counterattack,
like this sequences, is... Yeah.
And when we get a counterattack, triggers, you know, like, this is your run, this is your run, this is your run. It's not that crazy to say, like, it's late in the game, when Rice gets the ball in that position, you're pushing up.
I always see it's like, when you see amazing passes clipped up on Twitter and, like, comments are like, how did he even find him from there? It's like, he hasn't looked up and seen him there and then decided to play the pass. He's known he's going to play that pass into that space before he gets it, because he knows that it's pre-agreed that that guy should be in there.
And
that's how he's done it.
And you can train it. You can train it. You could be like, okay, in training, we're going to imagine it's the last 15 minutes of the game, and we're going to find a way for the right winger and the right back to get Declan Rice space at the corner of the box to whip a ball to the back stick. And Gyökeres, you run to the front post. Urdgaard, you run to the penalty spot. Or Eze, you run to the penalty spot. Incapié, you run to the back post. We have somebody coming in, like, on the edge of the box to try and, like, sweep anything up. You can do that. It's not that fucking hard. And again, like, you can do it with limited risk as well, because that means you can also plan your rest defense. You're like, okay, this is how we're going to try and throw a net over them. Like, these are things that when you need a goal late in games, like, there's a difference between teams. There are some teams that throw crosses in late in games, but they do not get criticism for doing it, because the crosses they throw in are not hopeless ones. They work positions to get good crosses, and they have people in the box in the positions to exploit them. That's very different from just aimlessly chucking crosses into the box. So I do think there's some stuff there. There are some edges that can be found. And of course, as well, you know, you could argue that Arsenal maybe just do need to keep the hammer down sometimes. Like, not all the time.
I fully agree.
But against, like, against Spurs, Spurs is a bit of a different game, you know. But against Spurs, it felt like Arsenal said, we're just going to keep attacking you and we're going to create chance. And does anyone really believe that if Arsenal kept the hammer down and kept trying to attack against Wolves, that Wolves would have been able to take the ball off them and win that game,
exactly.
or draw that game? Like, fuck off, bullshit. Like, whereas you give a Premier League team enough of the ball and they will create danger, because everyone in the Premier League is good.
Yeah.
The relegated teams this season are pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, West Ham could have beaten Man United. They were fucking unlucky not to beat Bournemouth this weekend. Like, they are putting up a lot in attack recently, and they're going to get relegated probably, you know? Like, Burnley aren't that talented, but Burnley have caused problems for people this season. Wolves are pretty good. Like, Wolves almost have... Mm. Wolves drew at Molineux with Arsenal. They almost drew with Arsenal at the Emirates. They did draw with Liverpool at Anfield. Like, Wolves have been...
Yeah, in big games, they've been all right.
Because of their position in the table, it's easy to think, like, they're actually terrible. But really, the different... And they are terrible, like, relative to the league, but they're not terrible relative to 20th place teams in previous editions of the Premier League, where they've been, like, the 20th place team in the Premier League.
Or just teams that people in the Premier League, teams in the Premier League would absolutely slap. Like,
yeah, like, it's like, okay, Wolves can come out and cause you problems. Like, they're not... I'm not saying they're, like, really good. But I'm saying that, like, if we made a league table of all the teams that have come 20th in the last 20 seasons of the Premier League, I would put this Wolves team probably win that league. Like, there are a lot, the teams that come 20th in the Premier League, generally speaking, are hideous. And Wolves are actually kind of okay. And even have some talent that you would quite like.
Yeah,
you know?
Wolves are a victim of bad recruitment and bad kind of, like, club management over a series of years, as opposed to just being a bad team.
And bad luck, I think, this season, because I think Burnley are worse than Wolves. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. It's just like, you know, Arsenal, like, retaining possession more would be good, and keeping the hammer down more would be good. You know, as Ted is fond of saying, and a lot of analytics guys are fond of saying.
Nobody saw the eye roll there, but I appreciate it.
Well, the approach you start the game with is designed to score goals and not concede goals.
Sure.
So the idea that, like, when you go a goal up, you should just, like, radically change how you're doing things is, like,
why?
I never understood it.
Especially against a team that's like got worse talent than you.
Yeah.
Just carry on playing as you're going to play. And also, I think be a bit more careful with your subs. Like, okay, everyone's like, fresh legs are good. But fresh legs that cannot cover ground and not run in behind, not as good. Like, it is better. I do think a tired Gyökeres is better to keep on late in a game than a slow Jesus sometimes. Because Jesus is not going to press and he's not threatened to run in behind. This is not always the case. And like, you know, with Jesus, like, I love Jesus. But you know, what I mean. Like, the guys you want are the
generally
guys who
speaking,
can keep,
yes, like, yeah,
who I can agree. Keep the other team honest and remain a threat and are good pressers. And
well, yeah, if they know you're not going to run in behind, they're going to push up.
Exactly. So that's the thing. I think, you know, you have to think about that kind of stuff. And quite often this season, it's felt like Arsenal just bring on Eze because he's the guy you bring on.
Yeah.
He's like the best guy.
He's
who's not
the next best guy on the bench.
Yeah, exactly. So he has to come on. And I think
versus game scenario, situation scenario.
Is it the game for you?
Yeah.
And again, I think Arteta also kind of gets too keyed into his things where he's like, I really trust this guy at the moment, so I want to play him all the time. That's fine.
Yeah, the kind of like hot hand fallacy.
But then we don't have a good squad. We don't have a good squad if we're not using it when we need it. So in those moments, I think it's worth saying, like somebody saying to him, we get you liking Capier. And he's the defensive fullback. He's the most defensive left back we've got. However, he's not what we need in this game. Mm-hmm. You need Lewis Skelly. Or just put on Lewis Skelly in midfield. You know, like just do so. Put on Lewis Skelly for a winger. It doesn't really matter. Like, as long as you've got somebody fast up front, that's fine. And if you've got somebody who can dribble out of pressure, like you push Declan Rice out to left wing. It doesn't matter if you're late in a game, you've got a 2-goal lead. But what you do need is the ability to relieve pressure. And think of it in those terms. So I think there are lots of edges here. And I do think that there are problems with Arsenal. But I also think these are problems with the best team in the league. As opposed to these are the problems which make them not the best team in the league.
Yeah.
Like the overwhelming probability is they win the title. I would not be shocked if they didn't. I would be shocked if by the end of the season I looked at Man City and said, well, yeah, Man City were just clearly better than them down the stretch. That would surprise me. All right, should we open up the burn book? All right, burn book time. I'm going to go with what I'm putting in the burn book to start because I think it's a bit depressing.
Okay.
Man, there was a thing with the BAFTAs this week.
Yeah.
So Robert Aramayo won Best Actor for this film where he's like playing John Davidson, who's like a guy with Tourette's and is a Tourette's campaigner. And during the ceremony, at a different point, Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo were presenting an award and John Davidson shouted out the N-word from the audience. And you can see how shocked they are. It's pretty bad. But the conversation it sparked afterwards, I think, has been so depressing and stupid. Like, I think the BBC made it way worse, right? And BAFTA made it worse. So Delroy Lindo said, like, look, nobody from BAFTA came and spoke to us afterwards. And I was like, that's fucking insane. Like, that's crazy. And the BBC, who aired this on a delay, aired this and then also cut out a separate bit of a black winner saying, like, free Palestine.
Yeah.
Which of course, like, then does prompt the question of, like, so why is one of these okay to say and one of them isn't? So, like, but in a
that
way,
that's... the conversation here. It's a conversation to be about the BBC.
Yeah. But instead, what we've had is this other conversation, which a bunch of people have waded into, who just need to shut the fuck up. Yeah. Like, Jamie Foxx got involved in it as well, where he was like, this guy meant what he said. And, like, you know, loads of people saying this. Or people saying, why has he even got that word in his head? Like, he must be a racist. And I just thought, you could solve this problem by Googling Tourette's.
Yeah.
Like, you really could.
Yeah.
And the problem is, you've now got, as a result of this reaction, you've now got people on one side who are basically like, this guy's a racist. Like, and if people with Tourette's are going to shout the N-word at black people, then people with Tourette's have to be kept away from black people. Or, like, they can't come to award shows, basically. So I was just like, okay, so people with Tourette's can't leave the house. Okay, that doesn't work for me. And then people on the other side basically saying that any of the hurt feelings about this, the upset feelings about this, are, like, ableist, you know, because you're, like, attacking a guy with Tourette's. And I was like, no, like, black people should be allowed to, like, go about their lives without being called the N-word. Like, that's fucked up. Like, it is fucked up. And that is the really difficult thing, right? Where you're just like, intelligent, rational people should be able to look at this and be like, this is really dreadful.
Yeah.
For Delroy Lindo, for Michael B. Jordan, for all the black people who are in the room, for everyone who saw it, everyone who watched the broadcast, like, it is awful. There's also this other side of it, which is like, this is a guy who has involuntary tics, and like, he doesn't decide to have these tics, you know? And actually, you could also argue that the reason that those words are the taboo words that come to mind are because, like, he lives in a racist society. He wouldn't shout those words if those words weren't used.
Yeah.
In our society, like, that's why he knows those fucking words, because he lives in a racist society. So it just feels like very demoralizing.
Yeah.
Because I thought, this is a situation where I think everybody deserves some grace and some kindness, and instead, like, basically nobody's getting any, or like only one person. It's like, well, I can give it to this, like, to this guy because he's got a disability, and then other people saying like, well, I can give it to this guy because that other guy said a racist word, and you're like, can you not give it to both? Can you not understand that, like, the guy with Tourette's is almost certainly using, like, every fucking, like, muscle in his body not to shout during this show, and knows that he's there to, like, celebrate this film, and certainly doesn't want, like, look, you can't imagine, like, there's no, even if he were a racist, like, he's not going to want to shout the N-word at fucking BAFTA, you know? Yeah. Like, why the fuck would he do that? However, two black actors have been called the N-word in public.
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking horrible. That's an awful thing to happen. And so, yeah, I've just found, like, the whole situation, like, very sad and demoralizing. And, like, everything I see on Instagram or whatever, it's just, like, people being insane. And, yeah, people like Jamie Foxx wading in, where I'm like, you just should know better, man. Like, you just should know better. Like, he could have literally said, like, he could have said anything that was, like, not this. Like, he could have said any message of sympathy for the guys. He could have been, like, even if he just said, like, wow, it is really fucked up. I as an audience member now am, like, hearing this at home. What is the BBC doing, for example?
Yeah.
And certainly, of course, like, there's the treatment in the room where, like, there's a duty of care to, like, black actors who've been called the N-word at your fucking award show. Like, do something. Like, go and make sure. Even just ask, like, how are you doing? Are you okay?
Yeah.
Like, we're really sorry that this fucking happened. Like, that's a completely reasonable. I mean, maybe you don't want to get sued, so they don't want to say sorry. But you're like, just go and be a fucking human. Though you know that it would be like, we'll send an assistant to do it or whatever. And that poor fucking assistant's got to be like, God. I don't, what do I say? Like, literally, what do you say? But yeah, I don't know. I just guess I found it, like, very, very sad that I thought, like, oh, can we not feel sympathy for two groups of people at the same time?
Yeah, I found it quite disheartening that the entire reason the film exists is to kind of shed light on the, I guess, the plight of Tourette's. And then the irony is when it is showcased in real time, in real life, there is a huge portion of society that still just isn't able to comprehend that this is, like, an involuntary thing that he is not at fault for, nor should, like, he shouldn't, like, have to apologize for something that he is involuntarily doing. That exists separately to the fact that the people who were subjected to the racial slur can also feel upset that they were subjected to a racial slur.
Yeah.
Those two can exist in isolation at the same time. Yeah, I saw loads of, like, tweets and stuff about, with, like, and I mean, like, some of these tweets had, like, 40,000-50,000 likes. Where the argument is basically, the main argument is always, like, if he can't control his tics, like his racial slur tics, he should know better than to attend a live televised event.
And then, he should live in a padded cell with no one to offend.
That argument was actually prefaced with the "I'm not being ableist," but, like, phrasing. So
you
it's
can't
like,
just claim you're not being ableist and then say something ableist. You can't be like I'm not racist, but all other races are inferior to white people. Like, you can't do that. I can't go up to Emma and be like, I'm not being sexist, but you should shut the fuck up and do what I tell you.
But it's like, it's literally, he's basically said, this person here, it was just a random person, I'm not being ableist, but here's an incredibly ableist opinion of mine.
His arguably the most ableist opinion you can have.
Yeah. And
most ableist sounds like it's bad grammar, but it's not. Like, but, yeah, sure. But it's like, can there be a more ableist argument than we should
just
segregate people with disabilities.
You should ban yourself.
There've actually been groups who've had this same idea, and they were not the good guys.
No.
So I found that one just like incredibly depressing this week, and I was like, you know, Emma and I were talking about it, and we said, what's upsetting about this is there's not an easy answer, and everybody pretending there's an easy answer is actually not engaging with the issue the way it needs to be engaged with. Like, there simply is not an easy answer there, and that's what's difficult about it.
Yeah, I also think the BBC have a huge amount to answer for here, because that was aired on a 2-hour delay.
Yeah.
So, like, say they were airing it with like a 3-minute delay, and before the programme started, before the broadcast started, they'd agreed any like pro-Palestinian political messages would be, they pre-agreed that like anything that I got, we're going to censor that. They didn't anticipate like a racial slur being shouted out. So there was no like plan of action in that event, and they didn't have time to like make a decision on whether it was appropriate to censor like John Davidson's tics.
I'd be like, guys.
Yeah. No, but it's still like a conversation.
You guys do know how Tourette's syndrome works, right?
but it's like, is it unfair to John Davidson to censor his tics or whatever? There's...
No.
Within like a 3-minute turnaround. Or
sure.
2-minute turnaround.
Though again, I think even in that situation, you could argue you should have thought about this in advance.
Sure. But
You invited him to the show. You can't be fucking like, you can't now be like, we didn't know he was going to have tics during the show. Oh my goodness. It's like that situation is more likely to produce.
But maybe they did do that, and they maybe said, oh, you know what? If he shouts fuck, it's fine. Like, we're not going to bleep that out because it's maybe insensitive to him.
Sure.
They just didn't anticipate him dropping the N word. I can kind of understand that there just wasn't enough time in that scenario to like have a crisis meeting and decide what is the most appropriate. They had 2 hours.
They had two hours.
Like, they had plenty of time to call like the most senior people responsible for the broadcast and make an actual decision on this. And I think that's a huge failing of the BBC as well.
Oh, no, I agree. I think the BBC completely fucked it. I think BAFTA completely fucked it.
Yeah.
But I also think that they could have mitigated the harm, but they could not have obviated the harm, you know, all they could have done is not made the situation worse, but the situation would still have been bad. And I just think that, like, to a degree, you just have to live with that situation being bad, because there's not a good solution, which is not essentially, like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'd be sympathetic though if black people said, well, look, allowing us to be called the N-word and deciding that that's like the acceptable circumstance, like, that is actually the oppression of a group. But when the solution is like, okay, well, we don't let people with Tourette's come out in public, then it's like, okay, but that's not a solution either. I can understand though if black people are like, okay, but you're now choosing to oppress our group over another group. Why do you lean that way rather than the other way? Like, why is one so much worse than the other?
I'd be quite open to that. And unstoppable.
But it
depends on like the culpability of action, I guess.
But again, I don't think it's clean. Like, I think
it's not. The thing is, this isn't an easy conversation.
But all I'm saying is that if a black person made that argument, I'd say,
yeah,
I kind of think that's fair enough. Like, in a way, we are like prioritizing the rights of, like, well, I'm not. It's not just this one guy, right? We're talking about all people with Tourette's, but we are essentially in this moment prioritizing like the rights of this one white guy over maybe the rights of black people in the room. Like, if, like, I do think that's kind of an unanswerable point. It's just that then my answer to it is, what's your choice?
Yeah,
like, what do you want to do? And then at the end of that argument, I'll probably say, well, that's pretty fucking ableist. Like, so it's just like, so you know, there's no way around it. I mean, there's a guy, I think his Instagram handle is like NYC Public Advocate. He's an American guy. He's a black guy with Tourette's, and he like made some videos about it, talking about it. And also talking about how it could have been handled afterwards. And I think that's kind of interesting, you know, to hear from somebody who knows what the fuck he's talking about on both sides. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I just found it sad this week that I thought, wow, nobody seems to really give a shit about the people here at all. Even Jamie Foxx, right, who was like, I'm so fucking offended online. I was like, even you, you're not, maybe privately you did, but I wasn't really hearing concern for others there. Like, it was his own anger, right? which again, I understand. Like, I'm not saying that's not legitimate, but I was like, even that person there is not saying, holy shit, like these poor guys in the room, being called the N-word on stage. Like, on a night, especially where they're being, you know, there to be fucking like celebrated too, you know, in a way, it's like they, I'm not saying it'd be better if you expected it, but they must have been like totally blindsided by it. Like, you can see the shock. So anyway, that's what I'm putting in the burn book this week, the whole reaction to that fucking situation. What are you putting in the burn book?
What I'm putting in the burn book are suction plates and bowls. So keeping it with the real heavy topics here, because okay. these motherfuckers are immensely annoying. I'm all for like safety proofing things for kids, or making things that like stop kids doing things that they should know that you don't want them to do. Child locks in the cabinet, great, providing they're like easily circumvented and used by adults. Suction plates are meant to be that. My issue with that is that whenever I try to move them, wash them, put food on them, touch them, even look at them, I cannot move these fuckers. These are like welded to whatever surface they're on. And that is what they're meant to do, right?
We never use these.
That is what they're meant to do. And there's like, depending on whether there's a bowl or a plate, there's 3 or 4 points of suction. So even just like peeling them off the surface is at minimum 2-hand job. Even then you're like struggling at points to kind of release all of the suction pads without another one kind of re-suctioning back onto the surface in the process. And this sounds like an amazing product because it's like, oh, you know what? We're basically super gluing the plate to the surface and you just as an adult have to deal with it because the intention is so that the child can't lift or move or like throw the plate anywhere. If that's the intention, you just need to suck it up and just deal with the byproduct of you also having to struggle with it. I would be okay with that if that was a thing. But the only scenario where these fucking plates or bowls don't seem to actually stick to anything is when you put them anywhere near a small child. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is about the physics. I don't know what it is about the angle of movement or whatever they do with their little hands. Anytime you put one of these suction plates in front of Bonnie, she just immediately is able to move it, shift it about, pop it out, pop it off. And I'm just like, right, this is the one thing you're meant to do. You're making my life infinitely more difficult. Like these plates, these suction plates, infinitely more difficult. And you're not doing the one function you're meant to do. And yeah, every time I touch them, every time I use them, every time you try and put them in the like cutlery drawer as well, because they're like actual suction plate, they start fucking with, not a cutlery drawer, your like crockery drawer, your plates and stuff. They start fucking with everything in there as well. You try and get a normal plate out, you have to like weigh it past the kid-proof ones, which then stick to everything. Yeah, really annoying. Annoying to wash, annoying to just generally interact with, and immensely annoying because the one thing they're meant to do, the one person they're meant to stick for, seemingly at least for us, is the one time that like they just seemingly just don't work. Or they're like, they might stick, but they'll like slide about. And then they'll slide about enough for her to move them to like, you know, when the on the high chairs and the tables, the way they always have the little rump at the edge. If she gets it to there enough, then obviously you've created enough of a gap in the suction for it to pop out. So like she can just fully, like you stick it down and you just, like the idea would be that you stick a plate down in front of her and like, cause she can feed herself like with her hands and also with cutlery as well. But if it was fully stationary and you knew it would be stationary, you could take her eyes off it for like 10, 15 seconds here while you go and like, grab something else. If you do that with her now, she'll just have it. She'll just be moving that shit about. She'll be dragging it towards her. She'll be like spilling it, her whole plate onto her like lap. The one job these things are meant to do, they don't do in our experience, in my experience at least. The only time they work is when I'm trying to use them. And maybe that's on me. Maybe it's a user issue, user error. But yeah, I could make my peace with it if they actually worked when we tried to use them with Bonnie. And we still use them. They just don't stick properly. Like we still use them as plates. But yeah, if they actually worked when they were meant to, I could make my peace with them being really annoying when I try and interact with them or wash them or put food on them or whatever, tidy them away. But it's like the worst of both worlds in that they work, they fuse themselves to everything when I'm trying to use them and nothing when they actually are meant to fuse themselves to a surface.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, given that you made this point to me earlier, I would say, no, you just remember when they don't work for you and remember when they do work when you don't want them to. So, you know, fuck you. But like, yeah, I always think there's a really good market to be had where you just make shit for parents the same shit that other people make for parents, but it actually works. Because all the shit that they make kind of half works. You know, it's like bibs, they kind of work, but they like, they're not water resistant at all. So they just get kind of like sodden and then that just like leaks through to the one underneath. You know, I mean the soft ones, like what's the point of those?
Even the like rubbery, like the not rubbery ones, but you know, the kind of like, they're fabricy, but they're also kind of plasticky. I thought those would be pretty waterproof. No, like if you wipe them down with a wet cloth, they are wet. Like you need to put them on a radiator or hang them up and they might be dry by dinner. Yeah. And often they're not. And you're like, well, what's the fucking point here? I'm going through like three bibs a day. The whole point was these are wiped clean. But when I wipe them, they get so wet that they're then rendered like unusable until like the next day when they dry, or you may as well just wash them.
Yeah, exactly. You're just like, I might as well just change your t-shirt.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, why does it matter? Like, it's the same thing. It's like, all I've done is add to the washing.
Yeah.
Like, just change her.
Which is one thing we're trying to avoid.
Or feed her shirtless. Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Like, which you can do in the summer, which is nice, but the rest of the year is a bit of a nightmare. Okay, what are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm putting in the burn book, no, sorry, taking out of the burn book this week, are the Winter Olympics.
Sure.
The Winter Olympics don't get much respect. They certainly don't get enough respect that they deserve. They are...
I would argue superior.
They are infinitely cooler than Summer Olympics. Infinitely cooler.
They're more, they're literally more rad. There's more rad shit.
There is so much rad shit. Like, nobody actually really takes them that seriously. Certainly not comparatively to the Summer Olympics. Like, if you think about the career that, like, Usain Bolt being able to create for himself from running 100 meters. And don't get me wrong, fantastic feat of athleticism that he was able to run that fast. But.
Nah.
The Winter Olympics.
Could do it.
Seem exclusively to have been created by people on copious amounts of cocaine. That's the only way I can, like, the ideation process for deciding what events are created and put in the Winter Olympics.
Yeah,
the amount
you
of cocaine that they have to have snorted must be in the kilos.
Yeah, because, though I do think the people who compete in the Winter Olympics are more weed people than they are cocaine people.
But I think the inception, the idea, like the ideation of these things.
I understand the point you're making.
Yeah.
But I would say that they are more like weedy. They're the weedier Olympics.
Sean White types.
Yeah, exactly.
Like hang loose Bruce. Yeah, for sure. But like, when you view some of these events in isolation, if you were to explain these events to somebody who'd never seen them before or didn't have any concept of winter sports, they would sound absolutely unhinged. The luge. Stick somebody on a little sled and fire them down this like ice chute at over 100 miles an hour with just a helmet. They even double up. Have you seen the like vertical spinning ones? They do a double luge. It's basically one person lying on the bottom and one person lying on the top.
But it's like a staggered spoon.
Yeah. It's like
the way
that
spoons actually stack up in your drawer. That's what it's like, yeah. It's like penis to lower back.
Yeah.
Rather than penis to ass.
Yeah.
Which would be distracting.
But sure, like, if one's not enough on this little sled, let's keep the sled roughly the same size, but just double up vertically. With another
they should
one.
Keep. They should keep.
You
doing
keep going,
it.
Yeah.
And yeah. Then, but also, so, like the everybody who's come to the Olympics with that country just like gradually gets stacked up, and they only stop when they like crash out.
But they do the skeleton right, which is the other way. They go in head first. They really put the head at the forefront of where the collision will be. But for whatever reason, they deem stacking that inappropriate. Like, there's no two person skeleton. Why? Like, why is the difference there?
Because it looks, I think we know.
but it's just like,
it does read different, I would say.
Only
to have one person face down on a toboggan and another lying on top of them, I do say.
Only
I would
slightly.
Say looks like the old prone bone. Like it's not ideal.
Only slightly, but also that's how they start like wrestling matches, like Olympic wrestling.
But instead, then they have the slow mo of like their asses like jiggling as they go down.
Yeah.
Like you have this shot of their like helmeted head and then behind them just like
Lycra.
Cake absolutely flying in all directions.
Yeah.
Because obviously all those men and women are really caked up because the one thing they train
explosive,
for is that like explosive start. So they've all got like fucking
big lips,
enormous
huge quads, huge things.
It's amazing. It's just like we should just like every nation bakes a cake and we throw it down the luge. Like it just doesn't matter.
But it's just like the whole concept is just so unhinged. And it's just so ridiculous. And even things like the biathlon, it's like free, like okay, it's like basically cross country skiing. It's like long distance running version, but we're gonna make you stop and shoot for a little bit with a little airsoft gun, and then you're gonna go back to skiing.
Yeah, I know,
like,
it's so
like,
weird.
Like great, like okay, obviously I am soon born out of like hunting or something, but stupid. And then like the free skiing, Just throw yourself down a mountain, do some flips along the way, and yeah. just like, cool, bro. Or like those little mountain to free skiing where there's the moguls, where yeah. they're like having to go like that. And then there's just a random ramp in the middle of it where you're like, yeah, just do a backflip on the way down.
Yeah, they're like we've got like 12 different ways of who's the fastest going down the hill on skis.
Yeah.
But like, they're just like, on this one, you have to go up and down. On this one, you go straight. On this one, you go side to side. On this one, you go side to side, but bigger. Like, yeah. it's you're like, who's the fastest down this fucking hill? Like, just have one guy who's fastest down the yeah. hill, one guy who's fastest up the hill. But no, the Winter Olympics is like, fuck that. Yeah. We're gonna do this like seriously, and it's great.
You see that guy doing like, he clocked like a 6 minute mile uphill on skis, which yeah. is truly outrageous.
He was flying.
Like a 6 minute mile running on flat is fast.
Yeah, and he was doing it in skis really uphill. Fast. Yeah. Like that cunt is huge as well.
Yeah.
The other thing that I liked about the Olympics is that guy, like Malinin, you know, the figure skater guy. They were like,
the one
this
who
guy,
does the backflips?
They were like, he has not lost in 2 years. Mm. He's the only guy who's ever landed this trick, and he's landed it like 8 times. And he absolutely fucking face planted. Like, it was great. Like, it was terrible. And I was like, that's what sport is all about, man. It's about underdog stories, but it's also about overdog stories.
Yeah,
where
yeah.
like the favorite absolutely fucks it. Like, that is great. That is what art should be.
Also, talking of favorites, Eileen Gu, big fan.
Yeah.
Big fan of Eileen Gu.
She's smart and she's hot. I also love what's her name, like the little figure skating girl, but she's just really alternative, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah. Like, she's got like the kind of like white
concentric
and black hair.
Circles but I've honestly like never seen somebody act like that in the Olympics, where I was like, she doesn't seem to be nervous at all. She was just kind of like, went out there, did her routine, was amazing, and was like, right, okay, you know, that's done. And they were like, yeah, you've won a gold medal. She just seemed so chill about it,
like,
that
so
I
aloof,
just thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, Winter Olympics, I couldn't agree more. The Winter Olympics, fucking slap. They had the Winter Olympics. I remember the Winter Olympics in my, I guess it mustn't have been my last year. I guess it must have been my third year of uni. And I watched like all of it that spring, because I was like, I didn't have exams. I'm fucking watching all the Winter Olympics. And I've loved them ever since. Like, they're great. They're always good. I'll turn on the Winter Olympics and watch anything, especially when it's like, this French woman, or this like stole her teammate's credit cards and nicked a bunch of money. Like,
yeah, there's a lot of drama.
And then won a bunch of golds. Like, every terrible person at the Olympics was amazing. It was incredible. Great time. That's also what sport's about. Where they're just like, this piece of shit, like, we're all rooting against them. And then it's just like, oh shit, he won 5 golds. That's cool. I like that. Like the guy, you know, the guy who was like, I cheated on my girlfriend.
Oh yeah, yeah.
he won a gold.
He won gold and then tried to use that as a platform to like grovel and get his girlfriend back.
That's kind of sick, you know, that he was like, sometimes you spot a lane and you've just got to take
it. That is one hell of a Hail Mary.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Anyway, I agree about this. What am I taking out of the Burma? Oh yeah, I read I Capture the Castle. This is a book my wife recommended. She was like, really formative book for me. And I was like, oh, what fucking nonsense is this going to be? It's written in like 1948. And it's just about like this girl, this 17-year-old girl, like with her family in this kind of like tumble down castle. Like, they're posh as fuck. And it's interwar. And it's a coming of age novel. Some Americans basically move into the kind of country house nearby, and they're just kind of growing up. And it's so funny and so charming and so good. And obviously it's like written in the style of the time, but it feels incredibly modern in like its observations and its depiction of what it's like to be 17. Like, there's still something about it that I think would ring true to everybody, and genuinely funny and touching. And I just thought at the end of it, I really wish I read this when I was 14, 15. And, you know, this is a book that ultimately, you know, Emma read it when she was kind of a 13-year-old girl. That is the optimal time to read this book. However, I'm reading it as a man who's like fucking closing in on 40. And I just had a great fucking time. It's just a really wonderful book. And it was just nice that I always think this with film. That with film, because my attitude, or my identification is like, I'm somebody who watches lots of films. It means that I watch films, I'll just watch whatever, you know? It's not like, oh, I will watch the stuff that seems like it's aimed at me, you know?
Oh, or
that
seems, yeah.
Right, I will just watch the stuff that's like going around or that's interesting to me. I will pick a film and just watch it. And as a result, I see loads of stuff that I never would have chosen to watch necessarily, but that I love. I get a lot of out of it. And similarly, you know, with this book, I was like, well, I just would never have chosen this book. Like Emma said to me, will you read this book? And as a result, I had this amazing experience I wouldn't have had by myself. So I do think sometimes it's worth doing that to say, what is a book that I would just never read? What is a film that I would never watch? What is an album I would never listen to? And that is the stuff that ultimately, even if you don't love the thing itself, I do think it makes you more appreciative of art generally. I think the more you appreciate art, the more you appreciate art. So if you listen to more music, the stuff that you like, you will like more. The more you know about music, right, the more you appreciate the music you like.
Mm.
And in order to know a lot about music, you need to consume a lot of music. Yeah. Anyway, I just had a really wonderful experience reading it, and I highly recommend it. And now Ted Knutson's reading it,
which is fun. I saw you shared that story.
Man, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, will you like it? Like, I don't know. You start feeling that feeling of exposure, you know, as if I've recommended something to you, which then you might hate.
Yeah.
But he definitely won't hate it. It's great. But, and also he's got a young daughter, so then he can recommend it to her and she'll like it. But yeah, I don't know. I was just like, great. Well, that means that now there are two of us who wouldn't have read it, who are reading it. Mm-hmm. So cool. Pretty cool. Highly recommend. Is that it? Have we done all of them?
That's us. I think that's a pod.
We better get out of here and get over to the fucking Patreon side because we've got bare questions. All right. Thank you very, very much for being here. Thank you to all of you also who subscribe. We will catch you over on the Patreon side. Thank you for all the people who sent questions in. Like, I must have had 30 submissions or something in the end. They kept coming in. Really, really great. We really do appreciate it. And in future, I might send, if I can be bothered, send out messages like this to make sure we get loads of questions because we do want to actually make the content people want to hear. So thank you for being here. See some of you later. And I don't know, bye. What else do I say? Yeah, bye.